usual. These subjects perform spectacularly well on tests of divergent thinking. But if aspects of their elastic thought processes are enhanced, ayahuasca, like other drugs, is a double-edged sword. The improvement in elastic thinking comes at the expense of their capacity for analytical thought. How do a few sips of awful tea exert such a wide-ranging effect on how we think? In Chapter 4, I talked about the neural hierarchies in our cortex. At the highest level in each hemisphere are the lobes, which are made of various modules, which in turn are made of submodules, in a scheme that can be followed all the way down to individual neurons. The 180 modules and submodules we've identified thus far send and receive signals via a complex web of neural wiring. The magical offshoot of all that is a flow of information that combines flexible bottom-up and executive top-down processing. Ayahuasca seems to function by interfering with those information flows, reducing top-down control and enhancing the influence of bottom-up processes. One consequence of that is a loosening of the cognitive grip exerted by the prefrontal cortex. Compared with the effects of marijuana and alcohol, the disruption of the usual paths of neural signal traffic caused by ayahuasca has a far broader and deeper effect, profoundly modifying the user's perception, experience of reality, and even, as with LSD and psilocybin, the sense of self. More research is needed to elucidate in greater detail the mechanism through which ayahuasca acts. With further research, though, pills to enhance elastic thinking might not be very far off. Some people, especially in Silicon Valley, are already using home-designed, quote, performance psychedelics, such as microdoses of LSD. Such drugs would be the natural partner to the analytical thinking focus boosters like Vyvanse and Adderall, which, though they may be addictive, are so common on college campuses, and the memory-boosting pills being developed to help Alzheimer's patients. Perhaps sometime in the future, we will have available a safe and balanced cocktail of such drugs to enhance our overall intelligence. If that were possible, those drugs would certainly be controversial. Some would oppose their use because they are against all mind-altering drugs. Others would point out that they give an unfair advantage to those who can afford them, or that they might have harmful side effects. On the other hand, to raise human intelligence could lead to great scientific and medical discoveries and innovations that could make life better for everyone. Whatever future research holds, don't go looking for ayahuasca pills just yet, for the disruption of mental hierarchies produced by the drug exerts a powerful and impractical downside. Allende said she faced demons and saw herself as a terrified four-year-old curled up on the floor, shivering, retching, and muttering for 2 days. "I think I went through an experience of death at a certain point," she said. "I was no longer a body or a soul or a spirit or anything. There was just a total, absolute void that you cannot even describe." The ayahuasca slayed her writer's block, but she concluded, "I don't ever want to do it again." The silver lining of fatigue. We've seen that drugs and alcohol can enhance elastic thinking by weakening our cognitive filters. Luckily, there are also more natural ways to liberate your elastic mind. In 2015, a group of researchers in France showed, for example, that the simple act of exhausting your executive brain before you start pondering a challenging intellectual issue can unleash your elastic brain to mount a more effective attack. The French scientists fatigued their subjects' executive brains by putting them through a tedious exercise called the Simon task. In it, participants are shown a set of left and right pointing arrows on a computer screen, one of which is always positioned at the screen's center. Subjects are instructed to press the left or right arrow key on the keyboard according to the direction in which that central arrow points. The key to the experiment is that, in order to focus on the central arrow, the subjects must suppress the influence of the other arrows. That suppression is accomplished by the subject's prefrontal cortex, and to perform that task over and over without a break for 40 minutes, as the subjects were asked to do, is mentally exhausting. After the Simon task had dulled the subject's executive faculties, the researchers presented them with a test of their elastic thinking. The subjects were given a few minutes to imagine as many uses as they could for a set of household objects, like a bucket, a newspaper, and a brick. Their answers were scored according to criteria, such as the total number of uses the subject was able to imagine, and the originality of each idea, as judged by the number of other subjects who had also thought of that use. The scores were then compared with those of a control group, who had not first engaged in the Simon task. The researchers found that when a subject's capacity for executive function was depleted, both the total number of imagined uses and their originality were significantly greater. The lesson is that, though we expect our best thinking time to be when we are fresh, our elastic thinking capacity may be highest when we feel burnt out. That's good to know when scheduling your tasks. You could be better at generating imaginative ideas if you do that kind of thinking after working on a chore that involves a period of tedious, focused effort that strains your powers of concentration. The French study also raises the question about our personal rhythms. Not everyone regularly feels their sharpest at a particular time of day, but for many, the labels morning person and evening person are well deserved. Studies confirm that our bodily processes, like heart rate, temperature, alertness, and the executive functioning of our prefrontal cortex, indeed follow regular daily rhythms. These vary from person to person, governed by a cluster of about 20,000 neurons in our hypothalamus, just above our brainstem. So if you find that you can sit down, focus, and grind through your spreadsheets, professional reading, and other analytical work with maximum efficiency in either the morning or the evening, there is a good physiological explanation. But the French study suggests a new wrinkle to that. Your elastic thinking ability may peak at the other end of the day, when your analytical powers are weakest. In 2011, a pair of scientists at Michigan State University investigated that issue in a study of 223 students at their university who had filled out a morningness-eveningness questionnaire to determine whether they fit the morning or evening person criteria. The subjects were asked, at random, to participate in the experiment either between 8:30 and 9:30 in the morning or between 4 and 5:30 in the afternoon. In other words, at the time they were tested, some were at their best and others at their worst. Each student was given paper, a pencil, and 6 problems to solve. They were allotted 4 minutes for each. 3 of the problems were riddles analogous to those cited in Chapter 5, such as the one about Marcia and Marjorie, girls born on the same day to the same mother and the same father, yet not twins. Finding the solution to these riddles required the subjects to engage in restructuring of their original framework of thought. In the case of Marcia and Marjorie, that means abandoning the picture of two girls that is suggested by the wording of the riddle, for the solution is that Marcia and Marjorie are triplets. The other 3 problems were straightforward analytical problems, the type that may require careful concentration, but can be solved systematically and don't demand elastic thinking. For example, Bob's father is 3 times as old as Bob. 4 years ago, Bob's father was 4 times older than Bob. How old are Bob and his father? While the students tested at their peak time solved more of the analytical problems, more of the riddles were solved by students tested in their off-peak hours, when their prefrontal cortex was not operating at full capacity. Fatigued people's more diffuse attentional focus, the researchers wrote, led them to widening their search through their knowledge network. That widening leads to better performance in problem-solving that requires elastic thinking. That's good information for those who, in the morning, find themselves in a mental haze, or those who, at the end of the day, feel fried and unable to concentrate. For me, it explains a lot. I'm a night person. I do science best late in the day, whereas, in my morning stupor, I have done things like crack an egg into the sink and then start to fry the shell in the skillet. And yet I noticed long ago that I'm more successful at writing during that foggy and otherwise useless morning time. I now understand why. Though success in science requires original ideas, once you have an idea, It takes quite a long time to work out its consequences. And it is in that analytical mode that you spend most of your time, hence my success doing science at night. By contrast, when I write, the need for elastic thinking is almost constant. As a result, my morning executive brain disability is an advantage in my writing. And so, I've learned to listen to my rhythms, that some activities are best done when I still have sleep in my eyes, and others, after the weight of the day has painted dark circles beneath them. Don't worry, be happy. On September 22, 1930, the Mother Superior of the North American Sisters of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, sent a letter to young nuns in different parts of the country, requesting that they write 300-word essays about their lives. Mostly in their early 20s, the nuns were asked to include outstanding and edifying events from their childhood and influences that led them to their religious life. The handwritten essays not only contained an accounting of information and feelings, they also reflected, in how they were written, each nun's personality. The essays were eventually filed away, and they sat untouched for decades. Then, 60 years after they were written, they were stumbled upon by a trio of longevity researchers from the University of Kentucky, whose work focused on retired nuns. Amazingly, 180 of the essay writers were among their own research subjects. Sensing an extraordinary opportunity, the scientists analyzed the essay's emotional content, classifying each as positive, negative, or neutral. And then, over the next 9 years of their study, they tabulated the correlation between the nuns' personal disposition and their lifespan. Their conclusion was astonishing. The nuns who'd been the most positive lived about 10 years longer than those who'd been the least. The nun study helped fuel a new field called positive psychology. Unlike much of psychology, which focuses on people's problems and mental illness, positive psychology focuses on enhancing positive feelings. It is about how you play to the strengths that help you thrive. It's an approach that has become popular with Fortune 500 companies because research shows that a happy workforce is more productive and creative. That brings us to another way you can relax your cognitive filters without resorting to drugs or technology, by simply improving your mood. To understand how that works, consider how positive and negative emotions differ. Negative emotions like fear, anger, sadness, and disgust elicit responses in our autonomic nervous system, such as an elevated heart rate or vomiting. These autonomic reactions reflect the evolutionary purpose of negative emotions. Each is associated with an urge to act in some particular way. They mean that something is wrong. In prehistoric times, they meant that some sort of danger lurked, that we needed to take action. Anger encourages us to attack. Fear propels us to flee. Disgust makes us spit out whatever we have ingested. By contrast, there is no autonomic reaction that distinguishes among different positive emotions. And there is no specific urge that results from happiness, no automatic reaction to serenity, no reflexive response to gratitude. Because negative emotion creates an instant focus on some particular behavioral response, it narrows the scope of possibilities that your cognitive filters allow through. As a result, a bad mood discourages elastic thinking. For example, in one experiment, negative emotions were induced by having subjects watch film clips of tragic situations. That created an analytic mindset, causing them to perform poorly in a challenge to produce novel word associations. Good moods are different. Since the positive emotions don't come with action items, they don't narrow your attention. What do they do? University of Michigan psychologist Barbara Fredrickson suggested that the purpose of positive emotions is to do precisely the opposite. Positive emotions, Fredrickson argued, prompt us to consider a wider range of thoughts and actions than are typical. They encourage us to create new relationships, expand our support network, explore our environment, and open ourselves to absorbing information. Those activities include resilience and lower stress, which is why a happy disposition contributes to survival and longevity. In order for our brain to accomplish that broadening of attention, Fredrickson reasoned, it must expand the realm of possibilities that our cognitive filters allow through. And that allows us to consider a broader range of solutions when we encounter problems. Experiments have supported her theory. Positive mood, they reveal, has an effect that is similar to getting high, enabling more original ideas to surface in our conscious minds. In one study, volunteers who were put into a good mood by watching a funny video or grazing on tasty refreshments did significantly better in tests of elastic thinking than a control group who spent the same period engaged in a mood-neutral activity. As it turns out, the converse is also true. Studies show that successfully applying elastic thinking to solve a problem stimulates your reward circuits and boosts your mood. The result is a virtuous circle in which positive mood and creative problem-solving reinforce each other. It's good to know the effect of a positive mood on our brains, but even more important is that positive psychology offers ways to achieve that. Its lessons are obviously useful in life, regardless of our desire to nurture elastic thinking. Some of the directives are self-evident, though we don't follow them as often as we should. For example, we'd all benefit from engaging in pleasurable activities, even those as simple as reading a novel or taking a hot bath, or taking time out to dwell on and celebrate good news, or to share with our friends their good news. The most famous activity that positive psychologists promote is the gratitude exercise, in which people are instructed to write down, regularly, three things for which they are grateful. These might be anything from a sunny day to good news about your health. Another intervention capitalizes on research into the satisfaction we derive from doing something for others. For example, on average, it cheers us up more to spend money on someone else than on ourselves. That intervention, called the kindness exercise, is identical to the gratitude exercise, except that you keep a tally of the nice things you have done for people. There has been research on other listing exercises as well. In each case, the key to their efficacy seems to be that they make you mindful of positive information about yourself. And then there is the defensive approach. Advice on how to banish cycles of negative thoughts that can invade our minds. The first step is to acknowledge a bad thought and to accept it without immediately attempting to suppress it. Acceptance tends to lessen the impact. Next, imagine that it is not you but a friend who is having the thought. What advice would you give that person? If that person made an error at work, for example, you might point out the person's overall positive track record, and that it is unreasonable to expect that you never make a mistake. Now focus on how that advice might apply to you. This defensive approach is powerful. It has even been found to help with the symptoms of depression. Of all the principles regarding how we open our minds to insight and discovery, to me, the best realization is that not only is happiness an end in itself, but it can be a strategy for mental productivity. For those of us who live life focused on what we need to get done rather than on what we need to make us feel good, it's nice to have a reason to add fostering a positive mood to our busy agenda. Where there's a will. A few years ago, my mother, who lived in a small house next door to me, needed a new blender. She was then in her late 80s. I told her I would pick one up for her or take her to Best Buy to get one. "No, it's too much trouble," she said. "I don't want to bother you." That was her answer to everything. If I said I was going to the grocery store, where I'd be spending $300 on a carload of food, she'd decline my offer to bring her back a quart of skim milk. She'd say I'd have too much to carry, as if I could handle the other 14 bags of food, but the added carton would give me a hernia. The truth was, she took pride in being independent. She walked the mile to the grocery store almost every day and saw an offer of help as an accusation of inadequacy. But Best Buy wasn't the grocery store. It would require a bus ride, and her arthritic legs had trouble getting up and down the steps. I thought about it for a moment, and then I had an idea. You can buy it online, I told her. Come over and I'll show you how. You can order it yourself. My mother was a woman who had never used a computer, and she read large print books with a magnifying glass. But she agreed. After much effort to find the absolutely cheapest offer, the purchase went relatively smoothly. I didn't tell her they'd be adding a shipping charge. A few days later, I popped in and saw the blender sitting on her kitchen counter. I smiled and said, "See how easy that was? It's a different world today." But she wasn't smiling. "It's very nice that a blender shows up on my doorstep," she said. "What's not so nice is that the blender doesn't work. So how do I get my money back? This new world is giving me heartburn." It was true. The blender was defective. We went to my house and navigated to the website, but it was difficult to find a clear refund policy. It seemed that not only would the return involve a trip to the post office, but she would also have to pay the postage. After we had wasted much time, I apologized for steering her wrong and told her to give up. So much for cheap internet deals. But she wouldn't have it. "Where there's a will, there's a way," she said. When I was growing up, that was my mother's favorite expression. How could I do both, my Hebrew school homework and study for my math test tomorrow? Where there's a will, there's a way. How can I possibly make enough money shoveling snow to go to the movies in 2 hours? Where there's a will, there's a way. To my mother, if I said I wanted to open a dry cleaning business on Mars, the fact that I'd be 249 million miles from my nearest customer wouldn't be the issue. It would be whether I was determined enough to do it. It was only when I got older that I realized where that attitude had come from, that she'd, where there's a will, there's a way, herself into surviving a Nazi slave labor camp, and into creating a decent life in this country, despite having lost everyone she loved, and arriving at Ellis Island, penniless and friendless. The next evening, I expected that she was still ruminating on the defective appliance, so I stopped by to talk about it some more. But as I stepped in her back door, I was surprised to see not one, but two identical blenders now sitting on her counter. "I went to Best Buy and tried to exchange it, but they wouldn't do it without a receipt," she told me. "So I bought another one. Took me all day. Good thing I don't work anymore." She said it as if she'd just retired that week, but she hadn't worked in 27 years. My mother appeared satisfied with the outcome. I was surprised at how quickly she'd gotten over losing money on the broken one. It wasn't like her. When I was growing up, if I tossed out a half-eaten orange, she'd look at me as if I were loading a fireplace with $100 bills. We talked for a while, and then, on my way out, I grabbed the busted blender to throw it in the trash. But she told me to leave it. "Why do you think I bought another one?" she said. "I'm not collecting them." I was confused. "I told you I'd figure it out," she said. "I'm going to return that broken one tomorrow with the receipt from the one I bought today. So this time, they'll offer to exchange it, but I'll ask for a refund instead. And since the first one was so cheap, I'll get back more money than I paid for it." She smiled as if she'd just won the trifecta at the racetrack, though I estimated her winnings at $3.17, minus four bus fares. I've talked a lot about the applications and triumphs of elastic thinking in business, science, and the arts. But just as important are the little ideas like my mother's, which come to us as we try to simply get through the day. I hope her "where there's a will, there's a way" mantra is one of the takeaways of this book. We face many challenges, and sometimes they seem insurmountable. But the human brain, given time and nurturing, has solved countless such problems. On the day she received the broken blender, within my mother's brain, a degree of neophilia attracted her to exploring her options. A reward system motivated her to think, to keep trying until she devised a way to get her money back. A default network of neurons created the associations that eventually generated her clever scheme, while her executive structures kept her attention focused, and her cognitive filters kept her from drowning in a multitude of crazy ideas. My mother is now 95. A few years ago, a fog began to roll in, and it has been thickening over time. It is now difficult for her to generate new ideas or imaginative approaches. Scientists tell us that this is because the connections between neurons waste away, weakening the communication between structures that are meant to work together. As we age, our neural connections dwindle, that balance of power is shifted, and the harmony disrupted. I tried, in writing this book, to provide some insight into those processes. Not because that's comforting when we or those we love begin to decline, but so that we can make the most of our abilities while we still possess them. In the preceding, I've described how elastic thinking arises. I've provided questionnaires to assess your proclivities, and I've outlined ways to nurture elastic thinking and overcome the barriers that impede it. Some of the suggestions I've offered will likely work for you, while others may not. There is no one-size-fits-all when it comes to the human mind. I've seen Deepak Chopra work on a book amid the noise and bustle of a train station and on an airplane. Physicist Richard Feynman liked to get ideas and scrawl equations while sipping 7-Up in a topless bar in Pasadena, in the days before the topless bars there gave way to tapas bars. On the other hand, Jim Davis, the creator of the Garfield comic strip, told me that he had to isolate himself in a hotel room for 4 days in order to have the uninterrupted peace of mind he needed to create that concept. Jonathan Franzen works alone in an office at the University of California, Santa Cruz, often under a spell so fragile that it is broken by the fragrance of an Indian professor down the hall heating curry in a microwave. I myself cannot do imaginative work if I feel there is a fixed time at which I must quit. And so, if I start work at 10 a.m., knowing that I have to put a meatloaf in the oven at 4 p.m., that will ruin my whole workday. Our differences are one of the reasons I've emphasized self-knowledge. Only we ourselves, through being mindful of how we operate, can choose the optimal practices for us to follow. Survival of the elastic. My father told me of an incident that occurred when he was working for a while as a supervisor of child slaves, laboring in a German munitions factory during World War II. As such, he was both a slave laborer himself and a small cog in the German war machine. What the Germans didn't know was that my father was also a leader in the local anti-Nazi underground. The children my father supervised cared for the chickens, goats, and other animals at the factory, whose presence I now regret I never asked him to explain. The workers were organized into groups of 30, and every day at precisely 5 a.m., my father had to gather his little ones in the cold for roll call. One day, however, when he looked over his kids, he was confronted with a surprise. He had 31. My father's eyes alighted on the new but familiar face, a boy perhaps 9 years of age, whose parents had been taken away and killed weeks earlier. My father thought the boy had been killed too, but he apparently managed to hide out. Until now. The child appeared puzzled. He obviously didn't understand why they were lined up. He didn't know that they were about to be counted. Nor did he know that the person in authority would not accept a count of 31 when the correct answer was 30. Before my father could talk to the boy, the Gestapo appeared. The lead officer made his count and turned to my father. "You have one extra," he said. The boy looked at my father confused. My father's mind raced to find an explanation for the anomaly, but his mental landscape was bare. An extra child could be shot on the spot. So could he, or all of them. With the Gestapo, you never knew. The officer stared at my father. Seconds ticked past, but his mind remained blank. The children's lives depended on his imagination, but he had let them down. And then the fugitive child stepped forward. "I have been sick for the last month, in the infirmary." He went on for a while, fluidly spinning a yarn, until the officer grew impatient and cut him off. Then the officer made a note on his clipboard. He said to my father, "Now you have 31, and he walked away. My father told me this story 3 decades after it happened, yet his eyes still welled up as he told it. That boy, just a young boy, he was like an adult. He thought so quickly. He created a tale, like Isaac Bashevis Singer or Malamud," my father said, putting his active imagination in the same league as the creations of those 2 great Jewish authors. Sometime afterward, everyone at the factory, my father included, was sent to a concentration camp. My father did not know whether the boy survived the camp, but, thanks to his powers of elastic thinking, he at least survived that day. People often speak of the various ways humans differ from other species. Killing members of our own is not one of them. Many aggressive species, such as wolves and chimpanzees, do that. But human murder is different from that practiced by other animals. We are the only species in which the intended victim can concoct a story to save himself. That distinction operates in 2 directions, both of them possible because of our ability to live in our imaginations. First, we have the ability to create stories. And second, we are susceptible to being convinced by them. War is a time of disruption. Because it brings rapid change, it requires flexibility and the ability to adapt. In those respects, it is a time much like our own, even in the regions of the world that are at peace. For in recent years, we've seen a technological revolution, an information revolution, and economic, political, and social upheavals. We've witnessed amazing new computer applications, sensational scientific discoveries, and a vast enrichment of our intellectual and cultural capital due to globalization. But we've also faced unprecedented new dilemmas. As our lives have flooded with novelty and change, they have become more hectic than ever, at both home and work. We are barraged by a constant stream of information, and thanks to all of our screens and devices, we are in ceaseless contact with dozens, hundreds, and even thousands of other people, rarely, if ever, enjoying any complete downtime. To be successful today, we must not only cope with the flood of knowledge and data about the present, we must also be able to anticipate the future, because change happens so rapidly that what works well now will be dated and irrelevant tomorrow. The world today is a moving target. Our brains are information processors and problem-solving machines, and certainly our analytical skills are crucial to meeting the challenges we face. But even more important today is the magic of elastic thinking, which can generate new, often wild, ideas. Some will prove useless, while others will culminate in the innovative solutions required for the problems of modern existence. To succeed in life today, we need to hone those adaptive skills. We are lucky to live in a time in which we have begun to understand so much about how the mind works. By describing each of the systems and processes involved in how your brain generates elastic thinking, I hope I have changed the way you think about thinking. And by describing the ways you can alter and tune that operation, I hope I've given some tools to take charge of it. Because there is much you can do to make yourself a more elastic thinker. This is Leonard Mlodinow. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change. This program was directed by Chris Koscheski, executive producers Janet Stark and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2018 by Leonard Mlodinow. Production copyright 2018 by Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.